This podcast is produced by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society. CDSS provides programs and resources like this podcast that support people in building and sustaining vibrant communities through participatory dance, music, and song. Want to support this podcast and our other work? Visit cdss.org to donate or become a member today.
One and a half around. Nine below one, couple, and four with six.
Look around to the right when you balance. Look around to your right and you balance once again.
Swing your partner.
Hey there, I'm Mary Wesley, and this is From the Mic, a podcast about North American social dance calling.
Nicely done.
Through conversations with callers across the continent, we'll explore the world of square, contra, and community dance callers. Why do they do it? How did they learn? What's their role on stage and off in shaping our dance communities? What can they tell us about the corner of the dance world that they know and love the best? Each episode, we'll talk to a different caller, but they all have something in common: a spark, a desire to lead, to share joy, to invite movement, to stand in that special place between the band and a room full of dancers, or people who don't yet know that they're dancers. And from the mic say, find a partner, let's dance. Hello and happy spring from the mic listeners. We're back with another caller conversation for you. This month, we're going down south to Atlanta, Georgia to hear from Sis Hinkle. Sis has delighted contra and square dancers since 1985 with her skilled teaching, welcoming manner, playful enthusiasm, and masterful selection of dances. She's in great demand at music and dance festivals all over the U.S., England, and Denmark. She's also the current president of Atlanta's Chattahoochee Contra Dancers. When she's not on the road, Sis teaches Tai Chi classes. In our conversation, Sis takes us back to the first time she stumbled into a contra dance in her native Atlanta, shares how she overcame stage fright and began calling all over the world, and brings us right up to her most recent pursuit, learning to call modern Western squares. We had a hoot. Here's Sis. Sis Hinkle, welcome to From the Mic.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for taking time after your exciting travels abroad, which I'll love to hear about. But now you're back on the home front. Where are you speaking to us from today?
I am in my home in Atlanta, Georgia.
Wonderful. And so I usually just kind of start from the beginning and try to get a sense of how you as a caller found your way to the mic. So would you kind of introduce a little bit of your background? Where did you find your way to traditional dancing? What was your way in, and how did you start calling?
Okay. Let's see. I stumbled into a dance. I had been living in upstate New York for a little bit and moved back home to Atlanta in 1980 and happened to notice a flyer somewhere that a band from Ithaca, where I had just moved from, was going to be playing this thing called the Contra Dance. And it happened that it was in the neighborhood I was living in. So I thought, well, heck, I go check this out. First person I saw when I walked in the door was my brother's best friend from high school. So that was handy. And the rest is history as far as dancing goes. That's what got me hooked back in 1980. And been dancing with this group here in Atlanta. We call ourselves the Chattahoochee Contra Dancers. We used to be Chattahoochee Country Dancers, but we got a little more specific lately. And about 1985, as a group, we realized that we needed to grow some more callers and musicians. And so did our sort of kind of sister group in Birmingham, Alabama. We all sort of grew up together. The folks that started, each of them knew each other and were musicians and played together and stuff. So we decided we would put on a weekend to train callers and bands, and we called it Country Dance College. And back in the day, we used to have just as much fun planning events and activities as we did doing them. So we got together and we figured out a fight song and an alma mater, and we gave each other student numbers like 3.14159, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, we had fun putting this thing together. And at the time, the first person we knew who was a traveling caller was Sandy Bradley from Seattle. She was like the only person we really had interacted with at that point, I think. And she, being a musician and a caller, could handle both sets of training. So we asked her to come, and she was our professor emeritus. And she called our regular Friday night dance that weekend, and then taught, I forget the order, probably musicians in the morning and callers in the afternoon or vice versa. And during the callers portion, she had us do some great exercises that worked, you know, like calling along with her as we danced. And then she gave each of us in groups of three or four some words to read at the microphone. It was like, you know, Alaman left with your left hand, back to your partner, you know, that kind of thing. And I think probably of the group I was up at the mic with, I was probably the loudest, because the plan for the weekend was that she would do workshops during the day. And then Saturday night was a dance called and played by the students.
Nice.
So that's pretty quick, jumping into calling a dance the first night. But she said, was asked for volunteers, and she turned to me and said, and you're going to call? Here, call this. And she handed me a card, and she put me on last, and she played with the band. You know, there were different little subsets of people playing, and she played with the band I called with. So I kind of figure it was a setup. It's entirely her fault that I'm doing what I'm doing today. So that's how I got started. And then, you know, after that, we were just sort of in our local group, call one or two in somebody else's program, and then split an evening, and, you know, as one does when you're starting off. And so it just sort of developed from there. That was back in 85.
Nice. It does sound like Sandy was on a mission.
Indeed.
And so take me from New York to the Chattahoochee Dancers, that's in Atlanta?
Yeah, I grew up in Atlanta.
Okay.
Went off to college in Michigan. When I graduated, I was kind of in the hippie mode. So I thought I would, before I ran off to California where everybody else was, I would go visit a friend in upstate New York. And I kind of never got away from there. So I was there for a few years. And actually once in Ithaca, I stumbled into a contra dance, but I was one of those beginners that, you know, just laughed and stumbled the whole time and didn't do it again. But once I got down here back home is where I started really discovering what dancing was all about. And back then we used to do contras and squares and English and, you know, a whole big mix. Unfortunately, not so much anymore, but that's what it used to be like.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about those early days in Atlanta. So you're saying there it was kind of maybe a broader umbrella of country dancing?
Yeah, the people that were teaching and calling were, you know, they were the ones who were sort of setting the agenda. And a few of them had gone to Pinewoods before, and some of them were, I don't even know where they learned to call or teach. But so we had, like I said, we had much more variety than is common these days. You know, we'd do a contra dance, then we'd do a square, then we might do a three-face three, that, you know, all the kind of interesting variety that is out there, but is not as often made use of these days. And then gradually our group sort of evolved into more and more contras and fewer other things. And then there was an English dance group that started up, and now we have sort of separate groups that is a lot of overlap of people, but it's, you know, run differently. So an English group and a contra group with a few squares sprinkled in for those of us who are into doing that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And what pulled you into the dance scene? And how did it, when you say the rest is history, you know,
what was the hook? Well, the music, of course, you know, and just discovering how much I always like to dance, but just, you know, kind of boogie dance, whatever. And being welcomed by that friend of my brother's and his wife, and just, you know, finding my people, kind of is what it felt like. And then gradually, more and more, that's where I found my friends. I mean, right now, I have very few friends that I didn't meet at a contra dance. Or some kind of a dance, but probably contra dance. So it's sort of become, as it, for many of us, I guess is the case, it's become my community. These are the people that I, you know, spend holidays with and see and such. So, yeah. You know, it evolved, but it was over time. And of course, the only person that I've spent a lot of time with who is not from the dance community is my boyfriend.
It's funny how that happens sometimes.
It is. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of go either way. Mm-hmm. But it's good. It's good to have that balance, you know.
It is. Yes. It's nice to
have someone that's got a different perspective.
Right. Who's not deeply immersed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And so when Sandy had you up there calling, were you calling a square or a contra?
No. All of us call contras. Yeah.
Okay.
Took me a while to get discover squares. And that was actually, other people got me down the square route, even though Sandy's a square caller, great square caller. But by the time I was calling for a bit, actually, I think the first memory I have of some conversation about it, that was Kathy Anderson, and whom I admire greatly and love dancing to and really love as a person. She asked me at some point, are you calling squares yet? And I said, no, I'm kind of square. I don't know. She said, oh, you will love them. So, and then I actually, what kicked started for me for calling squares was I took Larry Edelman's square dance callers course at Augusta in West Virginia. And back when I took it early on, it was all day for the whole week. In other words, we have morning, then we'd have lunch, and then we'd have afternoon. So we were doing square calling all the time. I think later years, it got to be like a half day, and then people would do other things. But it was deeply immersive, and Larry is a wonderful teacher. My memory is that his actual job out in the real world was learning styles. He was an expert in learning styles in general, not just dance learning. So the syllabus he put together and the way he presented it was just perfect. It was just fabulous. And when but at the time that I took that, I was living in Florida. I had moved to Florida for a few years. And so when I got back to Florida, or a friend of mine who lived in a nearby town had built himself a dance floor out back of his house. And so I said, well, okay, if I promise to buy the beer, can I come and have a dance, you know, practice calling squares at your house? And the word went out to the musicians, and I bought a case of beer, and a bunch of dancers came, and they let me, you know, stumble through and practice and get better at it. And I've often told people when they ask me how I learned to call squares, find 8 friends and put on some music and just, you know, it helps to buy the beer, but you don't have to.
I love that. Yeah, so I wonder, can you take me a little bit more through your learning process as a caller? Because I always find that interesting, and it can give a great snapshot both of kind of the environment you're in, which you've already started describing sort of some of these influences. You know, you're some big names. And I mean, I certainly associate you with square dance calling. So it's interesting to hear how that wasn't your starting point, but some of these other luminaries, Sandy Bradley, Larry Edelman, are kind of, Kathy Anderson, are kind of calling you in. But if you take yourself back, you know, what were some of the stepping stones? What do you remember about, you know, finding your way to really solid footing as a caller?
Right. Going from zero to whatever. Yeah, when I first, after that weekend, some of us from the weekend, some people said, no, I don't ever want to do that again. But some of us realized that we would like to learn, but we had callers here who were more than happy to be mentors here that called in Atlanta because they were anxious to have more people to call. So one of my local mentors, actually a couple of them, but one in particular, I would work out a program. Well, actually, first I would ask her, can I call a dance in your program? And she said, of course, and she would help me figure out what to call and how to say it and all that stuff. And then once I graduated to either doing a half night or a full night, I would still bring my entire program to her and say, okay, does this look good? You know, is there anything you would suggest? So she'd help me evaluate and see if I'd bitten off more than I could chew or what order things might want to be in and that kind of thing. So I had a whole lot of support from local folks. My friend Susan Davis was one of them that was particularly helpful in that. She and her husband, Scott Russell, were some of the people who started the dancing here and are still involved. And like I said, just starting out with a dance or two, and then another person who had started at the same weekend, he and I split a night or two. And since our group danced every Friday, there were quite a few times that we could, you know, plug in somewhere. So it didn't take a really long time to get to the point of feeling like I could try and do a half dance and then I could maybe do a whole dance. And this was in, like I said, 85. In 88, I moved to Florida, as I mentioned, and to Gainesville, Florida, and lived there for a few years. And when I moved down there, I had, I guess, started calling regular dances because I was calling when I got down there. And there was a sort of a ready-made group of friends to plug into because there was a dance group there. And one of the folks in Gainesville where I lived actually put on a dance week. So I got hired to call a week before I ever called a weekend.
Oh my gosh.
Because he wanted a local caller and then the out-of-town person that he had hired. And that week, it was between Christmas and New Year, so it was a little bit less than a week, but, you know, it was 5 days, something like that, 5 or 6. And the week before that happened, before that week started, I lost my dance cards. They were on
top
of my car, and I drove away without them.
I am
so you can just feel it, right? Right. You get the sinking in your stomach. And it, just serendipity, I had been at some dance weekend or something in the previous, I don't know, month or whatever, and noticed that a person there had a bunch of cards that were typed up. And I thought, well, I said, that's really cool. He said, oh yeah, I've got a database I keep them in. If you want a copy of my database, give me the money for the, you know, printing and the postage and I'll send it to you. So in the mail that week, before the week started, I got this big box of cards. So that saved my bacon.
Yeah.
I just had to learn a few dances, but it was very fortuitous. So that was entertaining.
Absolutely. And I'm just curious what parts of being a caller kind of sparked for you? I mean, it sounds like you're kind of focusing on like programming and choosing dances.
Yeah, actually, I don't actually know what kept me doing it, because I have often said for the first maybe 5 years that I was calling, before every single dance, I'd have to promise myself, I'll never make you do this again, because my stage fright was so bad. I was like, what on earth was I thinking? Why am I doing this? Oh my God, I'm going to die. And it would invariably go well enough that I would forget. So I would agree to do it again. And then again, I'd go through that same cycle of, oh my God, why did I do this? And it was not until, I guess I said about 5 years in, that I finally heard, I used to, back in the day especially, tell people, you know, new people out on the floor, that, you know, if you're doing it right, that's great, but if you're having a good time, that's fine, you know, it isn't all about doing it right, it's just, you know, and I finally heard what I said, and realized that it might apply to me too, and it took a while, but I finally internalized that, so the horrific stage fright finally dissipated, although it's still, you know, once in a blue moon, I'll get a little nervous, But man, it is kind of amazing that I stuck with it during all that time, because I was really petrified every time I got on stage.
That is an amazing story. And thank goodness you persevered. Mm-hmm. So then it sounds like back in Atlanta and in your local community, wherever you've been, but I know you've been in Atlanta for maybe the longest at this point, but it sounds like you've gotten pretty involved in lots of different facets of the dance community, to supporting training. Do you help mm-hmm. organize series at all?
Yeah, our group, I've been on what we call the steering committee, you know, the board, a number of times. I was actually on the board when COVID hit. I was president of the board when COVID hit. But in previous years, I'd been on it before and then off it. And, you know, so we kind of wrote, people step up to the plate every once in a while. And there's 9 folks. So we go through, you know, every year trying to find 3 more that will take the place of the 3 who are rolling off, that sort of thing. So yes, I've been involved in putting on things, the organizing part. I've been in charge of our dance weekend a number of times, you know, the chairperson of that, but not in the last few years, but over the years, 2 or 3 times. And love doing things like callers workshops. We haven't done one here in a long time, but in a way we have, because Seth Tepfer, you know, probably know Seth, also lives here, and he's a real dynamo. So at one point about, I don't know, maybe a couple of years ago, he decided or put out the word that he wanted to offer a callers workshop, callers class. And a bunch of folks met, and this, I think, it was toward the end of the COVID era, because I remember we were sitting outside and wanted to only do it if we were able to do it where there was fresh air and distance and all that kind of thing. But so he has some wonderful things that he's printed up, you know, some dances printed up and some suggestions and the things you have for a callers class. And a number of folks started, and then some fell by the wayside, but some have stuck with it. And after a little while, one of the folks in the group started saying, well, why don't we all meet at my house on Wednesday nights and we'll just practice? So now, even now, and this is at least 2 years, maybe 2.5, 3 years, it's been going on every Wednesday night at this person's house. And I was just there last night, as a matter of fact. And folks will bring a dance to try and call. And now we've got a few musicians that sit in sometimes. And it's just a very friendly little dance. And I sometimes sort of mentor folks, or if they have questions, they can check in with me when I'm there. And Seth comes too, and sometimes either one of us will also have a dance we'd like to try out that we're going to call it some weekend and we need to make sure it works and things like that. So it's fun to, I really love doing callers workshops at weekends and weeks and such. And it's been really nice to have some folks here in town that we can watch move through the process of learning how to do this. So yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like it keeps it kind of fresh for you.
Yeah, it is. It's sometimes I'm thinking, well, I'm ready to hang it up. And then I get to do something like this, and I remember how much I like watching the light bulb go on and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you highlight for new callers? What's when you're kind of breaking down the nuts and bolts of how to call? Where do you start?
What I usually start with is what is, as you'd know as a caller, probably one of the least important parts, but the part that people think is the hard part, which is figuring out how to say what you need to say when you need to say it. And I learned an exercise years ago from that mentor that I talked about, Susan Davis. She did this in a calls workshop once, and I thought, this is so cool. So I always tell people, first thing, you know, as you know, you have to finish saying what you're going to say before they do it. So rather than listening to the one, which is all, you know, have to make sure everybody knows what you mean by listening to the one of those 8 beats, you know, you have to listen to the 5, 6, 7, 8 or the 7, 8. So this exercise she gave me, and I tell them, you know, you can do this, and you can do it driving around in your car or sitting at home listening to music, just put on a record. And listen to it and count, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and go 1, 2, 3, 4 with somebody, do the next thing. Do, 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 with somebody, do the next thing. So you don't have to think about anything other than hearing when to say something. And then after you really get good at it, you go dun 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 dun, do the next thing. So you can listen for the 7, 8. So get that out of the way. And people go, oh, that's when you, oh. And then you get to the meat of the matter, you know, how to, all the other stuff that's so important, how to teach, and then eventually programming. But, you know, explain how to explain a dance, of course, is the most important part. Because if you teach it well, then all you're doing is reminding them. So, you know, then we have some exercises about how to teach and that sort of stuff. But that's usually, you know, if you do a workshop at a weekend, you basically get an hour and a half at most. So we'll get them to the point that everybody can say something and can call along with you when you call a dance, and then, you know, talk about how to practice at home.
What a great crash course. And I've loved that exercise. I've never heard that
the
before.
Best? Isn't that great? It's just, and I tell them, if you can't even remember those words, just go blah, 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 blah. You know, just get your mouth moving.
Absolutely.
The other thing I always try and tell people, but not everybody does it, is to move. You know, talk in time to the music now. Just walk around your house and talk in time to the music. Because if you're just talking and you're telling her to do a lady's chain, that's very different than with face across and a lady's chain. So, you know, getting them to recognize that you are the reason people might walk in time to the music, because your voice is what they're cueing to. So
yeah.
Little details like that.
I love that. And it's such good advice to think about, you know, involving your body too. Mm-hmm. I'm always, just because I'm kind of like a meta kind of person, like I'm always kind of like, how is this working, and observing myself. I really mm-hmm. notice, you know, if I'm calling a dance that I know really well and I'm in that place where I just don't even have to think about it. But it's so clear to me that in some way, like I'm doing the dance in my body, even if I am standing at the mic and really just kind of wiggling around a little bit.
Exactly. You got to bounce
doing
up
the
and
chain.
Down.
I am doing the exactly. lines forward and back.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Then circle, bottom, circle to the left, on to the next, and you do-si-do. Right hand just halfway. Chin salaman, ladies keep walking. Partner right, ladies salaman, gents keep walking. Neighbor. Give and take. Through to a do-si-do. Alaman. Ladies orbit, keep walking, girls. Partner, Alaman. Ladies in the middle, gents keep walking. There's your neighbor. Pass the way. Swing your neighbor. Give and take.
And then it's just such the big space from being in sync like that, and then sort of being at the very beginning where it's like, what do I say? What's the relationship between me mm-hmm. and the music and the dancers? And yeah. And so then when you started delving into squares, I mean, that's often for people who start with contra, which is very formulaic, that's often kind of the big jump where there's so much more freedom. The caller is responsible really fully for kind of every beat of mm-hmm. music and every movement that happens. So was that, and you said you were like you'd been a little nervous about squares. So how was it once Kathy and Larry kind of brought you in?
It took a while because, you know, like you say, it's very formulated to do contras, and you can start off by calling, you know, New England squares, and it's just like calling a contra in a square, but I'd personally rather dance a contra than a New England square, generally, because, you know, you're doing the same moves, but you can do a more for longer in a contra. So it was definitely Larry's workshop that got me recognizing that you don't have to fit it to 32 bars, you know, as long as you can keep them moving. He tried to, you know, teach us a little bit about how you could plan your breaks to make them fit 32 bars if you wanted. You know, a promenade takes 8 beats or half, you know, halfway, or 16 beats all the way and that kind of thing. So you can time it, but to recognize and to let go a little bit of having to be in the 32 bar mode. I'm still not that good at what people like Phil Jamieson do really well, which is the southern squares where you're just on the beat. It has nothing to do with the phrase, because I'm still so clued in to the phrase that I can call a square and have them start on the beginning of the A2, but I'm going to have them swing to the end of the A1. You know, I and part of it's because I'm always calling to contra dancers, so they are more comfortable if I don't start them in the middle of a phrase with something. But it's very freeing to recognize that you don't have to wait till the A1. You know, you don't have them standing around all the way to the end of the B2. So it took a while, I will definitely, but that practicing with friends, you know, where there's not such a, you don't have a room full of people waiting to see if you didn't do it right. You know, you've just got a square or two of people who are rooting for you because they just want to have a good time. And also the other thing I found that worked for me was calling in the square, because then you can just keep it moving. You don't want to stand still, so you'll just have them do stuff, you know, and just kind of make things up and get everybody moving with yourself involved, because then you know when to call the next thing, which only works if you have one square, but still. So that helped me. Squares are still, I love calling squares, but figuring out which ones for what crowd is always, you know, I have a very small set that I can call at our local dance just in my back pocket, you know, that I know will easily work. And another reason I don't much care for New England squares is most of them change partners. And my philosophy is most contra dancers are more, they ask somebody to dance and they want to dance with them. So I like squares where you do stuff and end up back with your partner for contra dance scenes. And so there's a few of them that I know that work pretty invariably. And then there's some others that, depending on the crowd, you can, you know, try some of those. But since I don't call every single week, I can get by with this fairly small batch of squares that I can pull out when I need them. But I just, that crowd that I called for, the British people over in Spain, they love squares. So because they would rather do something involved. I think people that are used to doing English dancing like the patterns and such that go along with that. So squares offer a pattern, and it isn't just about two swings and a little bit of filler, which is what a lot of modern contra dancing is these days. So they would be happy doing contra dances with like one swing, but with interesting choreography. And they love squares because, you know, it's going to be interesting choreography. So I had to really dig again to remember what I call when I do like a week-long squares workshop.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like you're incorporating squares where you can, but are you predominantly calling contras, or do you try to make sure you still kind of have that mix of traditions that you started out with?
Depends on where I am and what they want. You know, locally, I will always call a circle in an evening, like a local Friday night dance. I always call a circle, at least one square, maybe two, at least maybe a four-face four, if I, you know, depending on how much time we got and all that stuff. But it's still going to be three-quarters contras, or at least two-thirds contras. And that's just kind of the norm here, which is, I'm not bucking the trend. And I guess I should push it because it's local and they're not going to kick me out. But when I'm calling like a weekend somewhere else, I'll ask them what they want. You know, there are weekends that have told me, no, please no squares, and I'll do what they want. You know, so I'm the hired help. But if they will allow me to call a square, I will do that. And people, it is funny because there's a lot of people who think they don't like squares. And some of them come up to me and kind of like, don't tell anybody, but that was really fun. I really like that. So it's, you know, be nice if there was a little bit more. Part of the problem is that people don't get to call squares, so they don't get that good at it. So people think they aren't any fun because people are calling them that don't get to call them very often. So it's kind of a vicious circle as far as the squares falling out of the repertoire, I think.
Yeah. So. Do you enjoy when you kind of maybe have a convert? Satisfying?
It's thrilling anytime anybody comes up and says, you're going to call any squares? Or I really like that. Call another one. You know, it's just because it's so rare it's not the norm. And, you know, there's still places where people will sit down if I say it's a square, but I figured, you know, they get a break. It's all right. It's a short one. So don't worry about it. You'll be fine. So.
You sound very unflappable.
You know, we're here to have a good time, and I want people to have a good time. And if they're not going to have fun doing something that I like to call, then I won't do that. It's fine.
Yeah.
I have other things I can call. But personally, if I go to a dance and it's all contras, I often leave at the break because I get kind of bored. Bless my hips start to talk. You know, body parts are starting to say, yeah, all this round and round, it's enough. So.
Yeah. Are there things that have challenged you over the years, or, you know, I think we all have different ebbs and flows with anything that we do in life, mm-hmm. but have there been moments that give you pause?
I don't know. You mean in terms of the dance scene and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Or you know, what? your role as a caller, you know, how it fits into your life. Yeah, I guess I'm just curious people's relationship to calling over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, before the pandemic, I was making about half of my income as a dance caller and about half as a Tai Chi teacher.
Wow.
Now I teach one Tai Chi class and I call every once in a while. So most of my income these days is coming from Medicare. I mean, what do you call it? Social Security. But it was, you know, it was peace. I haven't worked a like regular salaried straight job in an office since 2003 when I got laid off.
Wow. Last time.
I was a software engineer. So I'd been working in computers for a number of years. So
yeah,
fortunately had a bit of a cushion. And after Good. That, just sort of tried to figure out what I wanted to do and stumbled into learning how to teach Tai Chi. And so that became more and more of my income and my activities. But during that time, I was also already on the calling circuit and still doing more and more of that. So those two were the big pieces of what I focused my time and energy on. And it's interesting now, actually, I'm calling, for years, I've been calling contras and, you know, traditional squares. Our local English group, I've been calling for English for the last, I don't know how many, few years, you know, 4 or 5 years, maybe locally. And then over Christmas week, I agreed to be the English caller at the John C. Campbell Folk School for Christmas, the week between Christmas and New Year's, which was quite a project.
Yeah.
You can imagine, I had two workshops a day and 7 nights of dancing, or 6 or 7, I forget. And I really had to beef up my repertoire quite a bit.
Yeah.
And my band was a local band that likes to practice. So I had to give them an idea of what I was going to call. And I actually sort of punted, and I think I gave them 150 tunes that we might use. And they were like, ah! But we did end up using about, I don't know, 65 of them in the course of that week. So that was the hardest I've worked at a dance thing in a very long time. But it was an interesting project, learning to do something new like that.
Yeah, and having a week to work with it, I mean, that must have paid off in terms of getting that material under your belt.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of it, but, you know, it also was challenging because we had a small turnout for the thing. So, you know, figuring out what would actually work with the people that were there and all that stuff. But that's always the way it is at a dance event. But for contras, I can do that without having to think about it too hard because I've done it for so long. But the English was like, ooh, I don't know, will this dance work well with this crowd? You know, so I'm still finding my way on the English front. but it's fun. I love the process of learning something new because the English, of course, there's a lot more to think about when you're programming an English dance, with key and meter and formation and all those things, which is what makes English so much fun. But
yeah.
So that's one of my newer dance projects. The other new dance project is that I am currently the caller for my local gay square dance group, Modern Western Squares.
Wow.
So I'm also learning how to call Modern Western Squares in the last several years, and I'm still learning. And that one is going to be a really long process, but
wonderful.
So it's keeping me interested, but every once in a while I think, okay, I'm ready to retire. None of this. I just want to stay home and cook and read.
Yeah, can you share more about the modern Western scene, where you mm-hmm. are and what it's been like to learn that repertoire?
Yeah, it's a whole different thing. I actually found out about it, I'd heard about that sort of thing for years, but I also used to always kind of look down my nose at it, like, oh, you have to go to classes to go to, I'm not going to do that. And then I was calling at a week-long, the Christmas week at Berea, actually, a number of years ago, and teaching, among other things, a square dance class all week. And one of the people in the class asked me one point after class, have you ever done any modern Western? And I said, no, I've thought about it, but I've heard that if I wanted to do it, I should find a gay square dance group because they're more fun, which is just the rumors that I had heard. And he said, oh my goodness, there's a great group in Atlanta, the Hotlanta Squares, they're really wonderful. And they are putting on the National Gay Square Dancing Convention next year. So I said, okay. So I came home and found that group and started taking the classes and learned how enough to go to the convention. And what I love about the gay side of the modern Western square dancing scene is that, like contrast, people change partners all the time. And anybody will dance with anybody, as opposed to what normally happens in the kind of traditional modern Western world, is you dance with your partner, and you know that's where the matching skirts and the string ties and all that stuff. And if there's any mixing around, it's usually this couple moves to that square kind of thing, rather than what we do in contra. So it always has felt much more familiar to me, because people are so willing to change around and invite everybody in. And one of the things that really stuck in my mind when I went to that very first convention, and I had not been dancing all that long, 5 months, 6 months, something like that, or maybe, about 6 months. The very first night, I went out on the floor and I was like, I need a boy, which is how you do it. You stand in the square and put up your hand. I need a boy. And somebody I'd never met walked up and said, let's dance. And so therefore, even more so than contra, you don't have to find a partner and go out on the floor. You go out on the floor and a partner will find you, which I think is just delightful. So anyway, once I got started with that, I got really interested in coming. I mean, the group I dance with is really nice and friendly. And I love, sort of like what I love about, one of the things I love about English dancing is the patterns are really interesting and it's great brain work. You mm-hmm. just have to follow the pattern and you have to learn the names of the moves and you have to be able to react to what the caller says. So it's like doing a no walkthrough contra all the time.
Right.
A hash, it's a hash contra basically, except there's a whole lot more moves, which is why you have to go to class, because you have to be able to react to any of this, say, 100 moves that is at the basic, what they call mainstream level. And a lot of them we already know, ladies chain, right and left through. And then there's scoot back and boys run and all these other things that, aren't part of our repertoire. So I now understand why you have to go to classes to go, but it's kind of, I wouldn't say dying out, but it's hard to get new people to come because it isn't like a contra. You can't just walk in off the street and dance the first night. You have to commit to these classes so that when you go to a dance, you can react to what the caller says. And not a whole lot of people are willing to put up with learning that many moves before they're officially allowed to dance. So it's a quandary, because those of us who like the pattern and the complication and all that stuff are happy we put the time in and would love other people to do it. But I understand totally that it would be nice if we had only 50 moves to work with or 30 moves to work with, you know, something kind of like the sort of thing that we can do for, you know, no walk through contras.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I love it. It sounds like such a fascinating new space for you to explore and also just find some of those elements that you love, the community and connection and, and yeah, I've certainly sort of heard that story of modern Western square dancing as the specialization, you know, just grew and grew. And then, you know, the numbers dwindled. It's kind of like you're in and you're all the way in. And then that curve, learning curve kind of gets steep. And I've also heard people theorize that contra dancing is
it's a cautionary tale
creeping that way. Yeah. Is that something that you sort of observe or think about?
Yes. I don't think we are likely to get that far, but anytime some new move is introduced, it's fine, you know, as long as you're willing to teach it every time, you know, you have a new group of people. But you don't want to have to come up with, like, for example, swing through is the name of half by the right, half by the left. Well, you can say turn half by the right and half by the left rather than teaching them a new move called swing through. So my urge is that callers don't use another name for something that they can prompt, so that the number of moves that people have to understand the meaning of is kept at a reasonable level. And, you know, the ones that we do regularly, I mean, people make up a new move like Mad Robin or Ricochet or whatever. And it's great. As long as you explain it, then once they understand it, it's part of the repertoire. But I don't know how many more new moves are likely to get introduced because, you know, we have a limited four people or a long line of people or whatever. So other than putting together the things we already know, there aren't that many topographically or geometrically possible things that one could create that, you know, that need a whole new naming convention and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's definitely a cautionary tale that I would say people should pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And you know, the whole techno contra. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I think is really fun every once in a while. And I don't think it's likely to take over, but that's what happened in square dancing. It used to always be live bands. Now it's almost always to records. And that, again, is not something that I see us going down that road, but it's something that I would hate to see us going down that road because, you know, the joy of contra dancing largely is dancing to those incredible musicians that we are lucky enough to know and meet and grow and all that. And I would really hate it if that became less and less the norm, which again, I don't see that happening. And I think techno is just a nice sideline, but that is the fear that some people had when techno began to get, you know, known around the country. It's like, oh no.
Yeah.
We need to keep live music.
Yeah. So. Yep. And so far I totally agree. It seems like it is a fun, playful new thing that's a great to have on the menu. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's nothing like that live band. Do you play any music yourself?
No, I don't. I own several instruments, but no, I don't play them. And I love to sing, but I don't sing that much. Even when I'm calling squares, I don't sing like I should. But
well, yeah, there's a whole part of the art form, isn't it? The,
oh my gosh,
the
yes.
voice and square dancing. And how did you find your square caller patter and presence? Because that's, you know, that's sort of a whole nother realm that you enter into. And there, I think there's a lot to do with using your voice as a contra dance caller too.
But squares
are different.
They are. And actually in modern Western, not everybody even uses it as much as you would expect. You know, the professionals do, the ones who travel and the ones who record are very good in rhythmic and, you know, they make it all fit the music well, not fit the phrase, but fit the music. fit the beat. And of course, for singing squares, you have to fit the music. But actually, when I'm calling squares, I'm pretty like for contra type squares, not the modern Western. I'm rhythmic and I can, you know, make it fit really pretty well. You know, I'm pretty at ease with that. But of course, those kind of squares, I'll teach the square and then people are just reacting to what I say and I just keep them moving. And it isn't like you have to make it up as you go along, which is what a really good modern Western square dance caller does. I can't do that at all. But the rhythmic, I mean, I think it's important to, as we were talking about earlier, I think it's important to be rhythmic when you're calling contras too, but it's really important when you're calling squares. Because you are, you know, you're the vocalist with the band. You're basically like you are singing a song, except you're not singing. You know, you're doing it in a rhythmic talking way, ideally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can make up breaks and things like that. But yeah, I like I said, I'm a little nervous about singing squares. So I kind of back off on that and I don't really do it like I should, because in theory, in modern Western, there's, you know, you do patter and then you do a singing call and you do patter and you do a singing call. And I just basically kind of chicken out and I just teach them a lot of stuff with patter and then wait till they go to a dance and they have to struggle through a singing call. So I'm not doing the best job I could for my square dance call, square dance students. But
well, you find your comfort zone. I didn't know that about the presence of singing calls in modern Western.
Yeah, that's your tradition at a dance. They call it a tip. And a tip is like a batch of dancing before you sit down. Mm-hmm. And a tip is usually made up of a bunch of patter. You know, they'll have you do a bunch of things and get back to your partner and a few more things, get back to your partner. Alamein left, right, left, right. And all that stuff. And then they'll do a singing call. And then you go sit down for a few minutes. And then you come back and do another tip. So that's the kind of traditional version. And that, you know, the singing squares that we do as part of Contra world are from that tradition, but from back in the day, you know, like Because, Just Because, and, you know, all the ones that we have done with wonderful callers like Ralph Sweet and such. That's just what they were doing back then, along with patter. And those are the ones that have survived into the contra dance scene from back in the day. But now it's things like, you know, the problem with singing calls is you have to buy the music from one of the sites where they have programmed it to fit 32 bars. Because there's a format, just like there is for, you know, all the ones that we do at contra dances, the singing calls. So, and each tune is like $7, you know, so
invest. You can't have
you have to invest in your library. So I've got a few, you know, a few that I know well, Summertime and King of the Road, things, you know, old fave songs that I feel like I could pull off. But I'm still nervous about doing it in such a way that people can actually get through it without stumbling and getting all confused. So I start a whole new class of beginners next week. So I'm determined I'm going to do more singing calls for them.
Oh, good for you. Well,
we'll see how it goes.
I wish you luck. It's always great, as you said, to be learning something new.
When you get home, we're going to try that break. You ready? Find your corner. Bottom left just halfway, Robin's star. Larks, run around the outside. There's your corner. Turn bottom left halfway. Larks, you star in the middle. Robin's orbit. There's your corner. Alamein left. Back to your partner. Pull on by. Do a right left. Grand around you fly. Swing your partner when you find him.
Do you write any dances as choreography in your toolbox as well?
A few. There's a few that I've written that people call and that I've called. I've written a few more than that, but they really weren't worth much, you know, just for an occasion, just for I needed a something or other. As a matter of fact, I wrote one when I was in Spain, or actually on the way to Spain, but I haven't tried it yet in real, you know, with real people, so I don't know if it'll work. But it's not one of my main skills. There's so many great dances out there, so I just interpret, you know. I follow the people who I know are good, Chris Page and, you know, Rick Moore and some of those people that I can trust, and all of their dances are going to work. So,
yeah, there's so much out there. And I know sometimes even just like making little adaptations to dances that exist too.
Exactly. I do that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this time I think we'll turn that one into a do-si-do-ing swing instead of a balancing swing, or I think I'll put in a long forward and back instead of a whatever, you know.
But right, yeah, stuff, and in response to the situation or the dancers that you're working with. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so you mentioned you were in Spain recently. You know, what has your touring caller life looked like over the years, and how, what is it presently?
Well, I don't really tour in the States anymore, just because it's so, you know, if you break even, you're doing well, and it's exhausting and all that sort of stuff, which it was fun back early on, but I'm too old for that stuff now, unless there's a band I just really want to hang out with. But, you know, I get hired for a weekend. I might do the local dance the night before or something like that. But in England, I've been over there many, many times and usually end up doing a bunch of local dances in addition to some weekend event that has helped me pay for my travel. You know, it's basically, if you break even, that's fine, but it's mostly, but I get to go to England, you know. And the same with, I've been to Denmark a number of times too, and that's always for a weekend. And occasionally I'll do a couple of local things because my friends who put me up have a group and I'll come and call for them, that kind of thing. But generally it's just coming to do a weekend. And when they bring you over to Denmark, they basically just pay for your airfare. Mm-hmm. They kind of figure, you know, we'll get you over here. It's not like you're making money off of the gig, but you get to come to Denmark.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's fun. And those are the only, besides this group that puts on the Spain, Portugal stuff, those are the only international, well, Canada, but you know, Canada's practically here.
So. Sure. And what's it like calling, you know, American social dancing in Europe?
Well, in England, it's interesting. I started going 03-ish when I first started going to England. I'd have to look it up. But anyway, when I first started going to England, the folks who did contra did it kind of like they do their English dance over there, which is a little bit plodding, and the music was a little heavy. You know, it was not like they'll play maybe an American contra dance tune, but it's still in an English style. But over the years, more and more people from there have either listened a lot to recordings or have been over here, or enough American bands have come over that they've gotten the sense of that this is a little bit different thing. So the music has gotten better for contra dancing over the years. And some of the folks in England, the way they do it is they have dance clubs generally, sort of like the square dances over here. You know, they go Wednesday night, they're going to the dance club. And at their dance clubs, they'll often do, you know, an English and then a square and then a contra and a triplet and, you know, kind of like we used to do. But the people in the clubs are, those clubs are usually still doing the contras and the squares kind of in same style as they do their, what they call social dance, which is what we call English dance. But then there have, in the last 10 or 15, 20 years, some groups have popped up that just do contra primarily, or contra and squares, American basically. And those are usually like a Friday night or a Saturday night. They're more like a dance as opposed to a weekly club kind of thing. And as the bands have gotten better and those more of those groups have started, then there's a subculture now over in England that does, you know, that shoots for doing contras and sort of in squares, kind of like we do. And it's fun to see that progression.
Yeah.
That's when it's the music has changed, the dancing has changed, and somewhat the calling has changed. I mean, there's younger callers taking this up too. And I remember when the first time I went to England and I went to a dance, and the caller there was, he was kind of making fun of the dancers, you know, like supposedly people he knew, but it was a little like that insulting banter back and forth, or saying something like, if you don't know your right from your left, I can't help you, that kind of thing. It's ha, 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 very cute. Well, I just wanted to slap him. It was like, that's not the way we do it here.
Yeah.
And, you know, and over the years, it's gotten, I think of it as kind of the British schoolmaster kind of vibe. And that has evolved over the years to being a lot more like what we're used to. People being really nice to the dancers and taking responsibility and emphasizing making it fun. And that's been really nice to watch. I mean, just because that's the way I like to have a dance happen. You know, I'd like to be at a dance where people are nice to me. And so it's been interesting watching that since I've been going over there for the last maybe 20 years. And it's just, you know, seeing the change over time. And the first time I went over was because there was a dancer, a fella named, it'll come to me. There was a dancer from England who came over here and actually came to one of those weeks that my friend put on in Florida.
Nice.
Was his first experience of American dancing. And he had so much fun that he came back the next November to our local dance weekend. And he had a good time, but he didn't really get to interact with people that much. So he let it be known to the people he was staying with. I would, I'd really love a pen pal or two. So if I ever come back, I will know people. So I thought, well, that's nice. So I wrote back and said, oh yeah, I'd love to meet you. And he was just all excited because the caller was the one that it was, you know. So next thing I knew, he had me booked for a folk festival over there. And Air Dance, do you remember Air Dance, when Rodney Miller's Air Dance?
Yes.
That was the first time they went over, and they were playing this folk festival, Sidmouth Folk Festival, which was the biggest folk festival in England. So they were scheduled to play at Sidmouth, and he arranged for me to call with them before I was even sure I could come. I mean, he just let me know, you're coming. And I said, oh, really? Wait a minute. I have this. So anyway, I had a gig I had to cancel. But anyway, so I came over and did a few other things with them, and then got to call it this week-long folk festival, which it actually, it was a real eye-opener for a lot of people because, you know, Rodney Miller and company played really differently than they were used to. And so the places where we danced, they had it in a big tent with a stage and a dance floor put down. And the line out the door before the thing was open to the people went around the tent and back, because the word had gotten out that these guys were so great.
Wow.
And it was really fun to watch the eyes going, you know, waking up to what dance music could be like. And so I was kind of there, what felt like the beginning of English folks getting a taste of what American contra dancing is like. So that's what started me going over there. Jim Robb is the name of the gentleman that I couldn't remember. And he brought me over every once or twice a year for a number of years. And
wow. Then
it was, unfortunately he passed on, but a good friend of mine kind of took it on and helped me out when I can get over there.
Amazing.
So that's the English side. And then the Danish side is a whole different thing, because in Denmark, they don't all speak English, but they all react to the calls in English.
Huh.
So normally the Danish callers will explain it in Danish and call it in English, but there was enough people there when I would come who could help each other out, you know, enough who could understand the English and such. But there's the reason there's even a dance scene or a contra dance scene in Denmark, which is aging out and kind of dying out now, but was because of an American who moved over there after college in like 1970.
Wow.
Or 75 or something like that. And she missed it. And she'd been in Berea, I think, is where maybe when she went to school. And she went over there and then started teaching dances. And then she started teaching contra callers. And So it just blossomed from there. And
wow.
So wow. It's pretty amazing.
That's just, yeah, the cross pollination is just really interesting, and especially with England kind of going back from, you know, going back to the motherland in some
exactly.
ways.
Exactly. And bringing them something that we've changed up a bit.
Yes. Yeah. And continue to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, exactly. I love it. Well, I feel like we've covered lots of ground. But great. Well, one thing I always like to hear about is how people curate and kind of store and organize their dance collections.
Ah, yes.
Which,
yes.
Once you recovered or restarted your dance collection, you probably became very meticulous about
You'd think I would, actually. You'd think I would be making copies of all my cards over the years. But actually, until I discovered Caller's Companion, which is the database that I rely entirely upon now. It's wonderful. It's almost exactly what I would have wanted to include if I was get around to writing a database.
Right, which you could do.
I theoretically could do, but I never did. But yeah, almost everything that I would want in such a thing is there. And I now more and more use it to plan. For a long, long time, I just used it to store my dances because I just started organically putting them in as I would, you know, call something off of my cards. And now not everything that I still have cards that aren't in there, but they're things that I haven't called in a long time. But I love that it records the sets. So I know what I called last time I was there at wherever there is. And now I'm beginning to finally more and more use it as a planning tool. I used to just use it as a recording tool, but I don't ever call off of it. And I probably never will because I really like the tactile, you know, can shuffle those cards around and move it from here to there. And if I was doing it on the computer, I just know something would go wrong and the thing would die and I would be stuck. So I like having the paper copies to call off of, but I like now trying to organize it and look at it. Because one of the, do you use it, by the way? Do you know that?
I don't actually. I am still cards only.
Mm-hmm. I love it, like I said, because of it records it and because there's a copy now of all of the dances that I call regularly. So if I was to lose all of my cards, I would have that. But it also, you have, you know, it's a database. So you have a database of dances and you have a database of sets, which is just the list of what you danced where, I mean, what you called where, and you can take notes on it. I don't usually, but, it also has, if you create a set, you can click on something called Program Matrix and it will show you, does every dance have a men's alaman left in it? Oh no, maybe I'll change one of those out, you know, or you can see how many circle left hand swings you have in every, you know, in the program. So you can get a kind of glimpse of what distribution of moves there are. And if you have three in a row that start with the forward and back, that I didn't notice that, you know. So it's kind of a nice little double check that you could get by looking at the cards, but it's just in a sort of a spreadsheet-y look, a format, this matrix. That lets you just glance at it and go, yeah, that looks pretty all right. And I think it's incredible that he put it together and sells it for what I consider a very nominal fee.
Yeah.
And it's really the thing that I rely on now to not lose track of my life. But when in my cards, I do still, you know, work a lot out of cards. You know, I'll take cards and flip through them and then I'll put it into the database. So as far as how I organize the cards, like in my box, I mean, I have thousands of cards, but if I kind of narrow them down to a box that I'm going to bring with me if I'm going to do a weekend or something, I've gotten to my current system is I clip together, you know, gem clip, you know, paper clip together all the ones I'm bringing along that have a Mad Robin and all the ones that are Hayes. So basically the sort of significant feature of that particular dance that I wouldn't call two of in a program, you know, like if I'm going to do a Mad Robin, I'm just going to probably do one in this set, you know? So I know that I, you know, it's of this batch, I'm going to do one of these. And Same with, you know, all basically, there's a lot of dances that are kind of generic or that don't have any particular move. It's just the combination that's fun. So those are all loose, but the ones that are in little clips, I know I can make sure that it sort of narrows down the ones I have to look at, but it knows that, all right, I do want to get one of these with a ricochet, or I want to call a hey sometime, you know. So that's my my attempt at organization.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, I have the contours together and the circles together and the squares together in my box. But
how big is your box? Have you had to move gradually
I've got umpteen boxes. But, you know, I just do a 3x5. I've never gone to the bigger cards. And I just narrow it down to what I need, what I'm going to use this week. But I also bring along blank cards, and I have my database with me on my iPad. So if I get there and on, you know, after calling Friday night, I realize, you know, I need some easier dances, or I need some trickier stuff. Then I'll flip through the database and maybe write out a few cards that I didn't bring with me. So it's sort of a hybrid situation. You know, I rely on the cards, but I have this backup with me so that I don't kick myself for having left some of my cards at home. So
that's nice.
Yeah.
And squares, you also keep in that same system?
I do, although, you know, squares are a little trickier to write out, but it's just, I type in enough of it that I can figure out what it is. And there's there's a bunch of squares that I have on cards that are not in the database, because I've either never called them or I've only called them at weekend square dance, I mean, week-long square dance calling things, and I've just never actually bothered to type them in.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you keep breaks in there too? Or are the breaks just all in your head?
No, I keep them in there too. Cause I can, when I record, I will, if you know, I'm putting the set or writing down what I did in the set portion, I do have the square and the break. So I can remember, okay, I already did that grand square. I'll do something else, you know? And especially when I'm doing again, a week long square dance workshop, it's nice to remember which breaks I did with which dances and, you know, and what I've got left that I can work with.
Yeah. It's interesting how callers are sort of by necessity collectors of material, but is that something that you also liked about becoming a caller? Did you kind of already have a collector mentality in any way, or is it just?
I guess probably. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of if there's any other aspect of my life that I accumulate recipes. Yeah. Once I started calling, I started buying up dance books and, you know, all that sort of thing. So I do have an entire wall of dance books that I don't look through that much anymore, but they're there if I ever get inspired.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the English is a whole different thing. I mean, English, I type into a Word document that I have this, you know, table that I have just created. So I'm calling English off of these, you know, 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, because then I can see them. So I haven't actually gotten a really efficient method for my English stuff, but I may not need that. Like, you know, I don't have to travel with a box of English cards.
Yeah. Yeah. And then do you have any pre or post dance rituals when you're kind of getting ready for a gig? Is there anything that you like to do to make sure you're ready to step on stage or kind of wind down afterwards?
I don't really.
Yeah.
I don't. I mean, I talk about things that you should do, but I never do them.
Yeah.
So no.
Yeah. You just show up and dive in.
Yeah, pretty much. Just get there.
Yeah. When you finish a dance, are you ready to hang out and socialize? Are you ready to go along home?
It depends. Yeah, like at calling the local dance here, I'm ready to go home and just chill, but I'm not ready to go to sleep. You know, I'm usually, you probably find this too, when you're kind of up after you've been on stage. So you got to wind down somehow. And at a weekend or something, I do love to just sit and hang out with the band or whoever's hangoutable. And maybe, you know, snack on some stuff, maybe drink a glass of wine, maybe not. But, you know, just wind down slowly as opposed to just going to bed. I can't quite shut it down that quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and my last question kind of relates to that, but I have been asking everyone that I talk to on the podcast if you know if you are an introvert or an extrovert.
I think I would probably, if I have to pick one, it would be extrovert. Mm-hmm. Mostly because
I think it's a spectrum, but
it is definitely a spectrum. I'm a little more on the extrovert side, partly because I or at least my estimate, and I'm, you know, armchair psychologist here, but I am pretty comfortable just sort of being thrown into a, you know, into a group of people that I don't know. I can usually figure out some way to have a conversation or whatever. The older I get, the more I like having time on my own, you know, like chill time or just personal time. But I don't have to have it. I mean, I know people that are, that would probably rank themselves as complete introverts really have to have a lot of downtime and a lot of privacy. And I need that, but not to the extent that some folks I know do. So I think probably I am beyond on the extroverted half, but not way out at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I find that it's a whole range, and I ask about it just because part of being a caller involves, you know, kind of being at the center of a large group of people, and it's interesting that people who relate differently to that introvert extrovert scale, you know, everybody there's a different way for everyone to come to it.
There is, and it's interesting. There are certain callers, and I don't need to mention any names, but there are some well-known callers whom I know who are on stage. They seem to be such an extrovert, and when you get them off stage, you can't get a word out of them. And, you know, I think that they are truly introverts who can put on the, you know, the mask of being an extrovert to perform.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to be able to do that. Well, you don't have to. Some people are very, you know, toned down when they call, and that's fine. That's great. But it's very interesting to me to know those folks who just really don't seem like, if you only had met them on stage, you would never guess that they were a person who could get up there and command an entire room of people and tell them what to do and keep them entertained.
Yeah.
it's a mystery.
Yeah. And how is that part of the job for you? Do you enjoy being on stage? Do you feel like a performer when you're in that role? You know, I think everyone has a different approach to being at the mic.
I think I feel like I am there to entertain to a point. I mean, I don't want it to be about me, but I do want people to relax and have a good time. So I want to kind of josh them along, but I really feel like I'm there kind of to facilitate the connection between the band and the dancers. So if I can get them having fun to the dance and then get the heck out of the way, then I feel like I've done my job, and then I can just groove with the band, you know, stand on stage and bounce around and, you know, throw in a word here and there if people need it. But so, yeah, I do like the entertainment aspect. If I can stay relaxed and just say a couple of funny things that will get people to relax and laugh, you know, that's. I'm certainly not a comedian. You know, I can't get up and tell a joke for my life depending on it. But I do feel like I can kind of set a relaxed and fun tone most of the time. And that's, to me, kind of my job, is to get people to recognize that they're here to have a good time. And the way we're going to have a good time is I'm going to show you how to do this dance thing, you know? So, and I don't know about you, but when I'm looking out at a crowd, and usually this is more pertinent on a local dance than in a weekend, but even in a weekend, the people I'm focused on are the new people, or the people that are least comfortable, or, you know, that need more help. And because everybody else can take care of them. They can have a good time no matter what we do. So I figure if I can get those folks to relax and have a good time, then everybody's going to do great. Everybody's going to have a wonderful evening. So that's my primary goal is to make sure if there are any newcomers in the room, they're going to they're going to have fun.
And I'm sure they do. Oh, well, sis, it is great to get to chat with you. I regret that we haven't had more time in person. I've certainly been on the dance floor enjoying your calls, but I hope in the future that we...
Yeah, maybe sometime we'll both get to be hanging out at a weekend where neither of us is calling and we can dance.
Yeah, we can dance. We can
have a dance with each other.
Have a glass of wine after.
Exactly.
All the things.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Take care, dear, and have a good evening, and I'll see you someday.
Thanks so much to Sis for talking with me. You can check out the show notes for today's episode at cdss.org/podcasts. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams and me, Mary Wesley. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit cdss.org/podcasts for more info. Happy dancing!
The views expressed in this podcast are of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect those of CDSS.